Today's program was brought to you by Blueprint, the original juice cleanse program to offer different levels of intensity depending on your needs and current diet. For more information, visit blueprint.com. You're listening to heritageradionetwork.org, a nonprofit, member-supported radio station. We're millions strong, with folks tuning in from over 200 countries. We are education. We are entertainment. We are the future of food. May is our membership drive. Become a member and support us while receiving e-newsletters, advanced invites, special discounts, and a membership card. We need your support. Visit our website and click the donate button to become a member today. Thank you for believing in us and enjoy the show.
Hello and welcome. My name is Isabella Wojcik. I'm with the James Beard Foundation. Welcome to Taste Matters on heritageradionetwork.org. I'm so excited to be here this morning, specifically on Heritage Radio Network. It's an incredible place to learn and listen, and we encourage, of course, you to join. May is membership drive. So just go to heritageradionetwork.org. Click on the donate button, learn more about it, and certainly listen to Taste Matters with Mitchell Davis in the archives. I'm thrilled to be here. Today, I am welcoming my guest to the show, Emily Lucchetti. Emily, are you on the line?
I am here.
Fantastic. Hello. Hey, Emily. Good morning. So a word about Emily. And again, such a pleasure to have you. Thank you for being on the show. Emily Lucchetti is a James Beard two-time recognized winner, both in 2004 for Pastry Chef of the Year. And then last year, 2012, she was inducted into the James Beard's Who's Who in Food and Beverage. So very great distinctions. And those are just two of a long list of accolades. Emily Lucchetti is sort of by official title, executive pastry chef for Farallon and Water Bar, two outstanding restaurants in San Francisco. In conversation, she mentioned to me that she was broadening her scope and changing that title to chief pastry officer, which I love. So welcome, chief pastry officer Emily Lucchetti, to the show.
Thank you. Well, you know, it is kind of a self-made title because with Executive Pastry Chef, I oversee both the pastry departments of Farallon and Water Bar, but the two pastry chefs, Angela Gong at Water Bar and Terry Wu at Farallon, are so fabulous, and they do so much of the creative work as well as the day-to-day work that I thought, you know, it's time they get more recognition, because if my title is Executive Pastry Chef, people think that I'm doing all the brainstorming and all the innovating and all that. So I said, you know, we have to give them more credit. And then I said, well, what's my title going to be? There's no one like to look to, you know, and to see what I should have done. So I said, well, how about Chief Pastry Officer?
Well, so on that topic, here's what I wanted to, break up the segment into two parts, really. One, to talk about, I just mentioned your awards and James Beard Awards specifically. So I wanted to talk a little bit about what that means, the bigger scope. It's a very exciting time in our calendar. Our big spectacle awards weekend is coming up. And there are two different categories, two different nights and a whole weekend of activities. So I wanted to touch upon that, and then really maybe delve into more the life of a pastry chef, and kind of trends in pastry. And we will definitely get to kind of talking about, you know, the pastry chefs that you just mentioned at your restaurant. So let's start off immediately by talking about James Beard Awards. And for listeners, if you have any questions, we're on live. Make sure you're tweeting. Probably the fastest ways to reach us, Taste Matters, HRN is the handle, but you can certainly call in to 718-497-2128 or email to info@heritageradionetwork.org for the next, you know, 27 minutes. So James Beard Awards started in 1990. It's really a recognition award. It's not a monetary award. It's recognition by peers. So it includes everyone in the food and beverage industry, peers like James Beard, previous winners, writers, journalists. Emily, you yourself have been chair of the awards committee, which governs kind of the process of the awards. And I wanted to mention, currently, we're also thrilled to have you as chair of our board of our trustees. So in that capacity, in that role, you've been involved. But what that means is our Beard Awards are coming up on Friday, May 3rd. We have the Book Broadcast and Journalism Awards. It's and then on Monday, it's the big spectacle at Lincoln Center, May 6th this year. James Beard Awards in the categories of chefs and restaurateurs and wine and spirit professionals, and so on. And there's about 59 award categories. So for all of that, for the James Beard Awards at Lincoln Center, we kind of liken that to the Oscars, if you will. There's the red carpet, there's 2,000 people at Lincoln Center, there's this venerable venue, there's tearing of the envelopes, there's, we hope, not too cheesy speeches, and segments. Friday night, the Book Broadcast and Journalism Awards, we kind of liken them to the Golden Globes. You're seated at dinner, it's really by invitation, you're in a room full of cookbook authors, editors, journalists, but that kind of excitement and anticipation is palpable, and you've been on both sides of that. You've been both for the book awards for your books, and I should mention you have 6 to your credit, and then certainly as the pastry chef when you were a nominee. So tell us a little bit about that kind of an experience. What was it like for you as the professional that you are to have your work, even be nominated and then to win? Can you talk to us about that?
Well, you know, it's really interesting. You're part of a community of chefs. When you work in restaurants and you're a chef in the United States, you know a lot of people just because you go to events and, you see people. And you really feel that there is a strong community, that everyone is kind of looking out for everyone else. Everyone wants to be the best. But at the same time, they want the other guy to succeed too, and we're always very inquisitive of what other people are doing and keeping tabs on what other people are doing, just for our own knowledge and information, and just because it's also fun.
Right.
And so when I got nominated the first time by the foundation, I was really, really excited because it was a recognition of, people appreciating what you do and the work that you're putting into it. And it's not like a they like me popularity thing, but more it's like you feel like you're actually making a mark with what you do. And obviously, not obviously, but, this is important, especially for people that aren't in the field or younger people. If you can't be in this profession and live for awards and wait for awards and have that your mantra to get up every morning and say, I'm going to get an award, because it has to be that you get the internal satisfaction of making a good product, making your customers happy, that kind of thing. So it's much more of a grassroots level. So when you do get a nomination, it's kind of, as a pastry chef would say, it's the icing on the cake. You know, the cake's good on its own, but the icing is pretty darn nice. And then when you go and you win that, it's just like, the double layer, a double helping of icing, and you do, obviously when I was nominated twice, and I didn't win, and obviously you always want to win, but still you're excited that you were nominated and you were a part of, what people were watching for, in my case, desserts across the United States.
Okay, so on Monday night, the Outstanding Pastry Chef category, the nominees this year are, and I'm just going to read them off quickly, Dominique Ansel, who's got a pastry, beautiful bakery here in New York City by the same name,
right.
Dominique Ansel Bakery. There's Melissa Chu, who's the pastry chef at Aziza in your hometown in San Francisco. There's Ken Forkish, Ken's Artisan Bakery in Portland, Oregon. Hedy Goldsmith, who's the pastry chef at Michael's Genuine Food and Drink in Miami, among a couple of other of his restaurants. And then Brooks Headley, who's the pastry chef here in New York City at Del Posto Restaurant. So those are all very qualified, very strong contenders. There's nice geographic representation.
And there's also stylistic representation, which is really cool. One's a bakery in Portland, and one's a French patisserie in Manhattan, and Brooks is Italian. So what it's really fun to see, and I think that's where kind of pastry has evolved in the last 20 years or so since they've been giving the award, you really get a wide kind of style and people really kind of doing their own things. I mean, if you had each one of those desserts in front of you, one, just because I know all these people and I've had all their desserts, I could probably say, that's a Melissa dessert, that's a Ken dessert, that's a, a Brooks dessert. But also, it's just stylistically, they're also identifiable and they're also unique.
So how is it a little bit like if you have a bakery pastry versus, you know, a very very complex dessert menu at a restaurant? Is it fair to compare them? Is it like apples and oranges, or do you feel like they sort of are at the top of their profession, they're experts in whatever they, you know, whatever their business model is, and that it is very fair, and that, you know, someone's got to win, and then there'll be four nominees?
Yeah, I think it is very fair. I mean, bakery and, you know, pastry, working in a restaurant are two different things. You know, when kids come out of school and they say, where should I work? I say, work at one and then work at the other very early in your career, because certain personalities are drawn to either the restaurant, you know, part of the excitement and the adrenaline and all that, or they want to run more of a pastry shop. So it's very personality driven of which one I think a pastry chef would run. And, you know, once you do that, I think, you know, it is a different skill set. There are different requirements that are involved to make something successful, but they each have their pluses and their minuses, and they each have their major challenges. So even though they're apples and oranges, they're both very, very, you know, important, and they're both very strong, and they're both very difficult to do. So I think since they are both desserts, I think you can compare them in the same category.
Okay. You think the hours are any easier in one category over another?
No, I think one, you're getting in restaurants, you're just staying up later, and bakery, you're usually getting up earlier. So it depends on if you're a morning person or an right. afternoon person.
Thank you, Emily. This is Isabella. I'm with Taste Matters. You're listening to a show that's devoted both to our guest, Emily, who's pastry chef and sage. Also, our upcoming James Beard Award. So let's talk about the awards process itself. I mentioned there are two separate kinds of awards. Book broadcast journalism, as you can imagine, is really cookbook authors. It is all forms of journalism, print, electronic, media, web-based, television, broadcast. It's an ever-expanding category, certainly, as technology is introduced.
Right, as we have to stay on top of it.
And then the Monday Night Awards are really kind of regional chef awards. Pastry's outstanding pastry. There's an outstanding chef of the year, which is really sort of someone who's risen through many years of experience and acknowledgments. But there's wine and spirit professionals. There's restaurant service. So let's talk about, I know for book broadcast journalism, you know, there are very specific rules and guidelines, and they're certainly outlined on our website, jamesbeard.org, for the submission process. You know, publishers submit books and writers submit pieces, et cetera. But let's talk about chefs and restaurants, pastry chefs, and so forth. What is that nomination process? Can you illuminate that for us a little bit?
Right. Well, the first kind of go-around is that there's, on the James Beard website, there's a call for nominees, and anyone, you know, who has access to a computer can go in and send in names. And so we get hundreds of thousands of names, you know, written in for various, you know, various candidates.
It's like a suggestion in a suggestion box, right?
Sorry?
It's like a suggestion in a suggestion box.
Yeah. It's open to anybody and everybody. And then what happens is that list is then culled down and organized and everything to 20 people. And that list of 20 people is sent out to past award winners, journalists, and judges, and a whole list of, you know, a long list of people in the business, in the industry, across the United States. And then within that 20 list, you vote for 5 people. Mm-hmm. And then they pick the top 5 out of that, and then they send those out, and those are the ones that are the finalists. And or the nominees, I should say. And about 3 years ago, we started presenting and publicizing the list of 20, because we originally were just doing the list of 5 at the, you know, the nominees at the end that go to the ceremony where they will then open the envelope and say the winner is. But we were thinking, you know, it's pretty darn cool and pretty darn good to get up to be one of the top 20 in any category, regardless of if it's pastry or chef of Atlanta or wherever. Or the South. So right. We started doing that.
No, it's very smart. Thank you for explaining that. I should also add that in terms of the network of judges and people who get to vote, no one is at that point in time you know, qualified or being considered for an award. So we're keeping that idea of people who merit an award or part of the consideration don't have access to voting in that moment in time. So we want to make sure.
Correct. If you're on the Book Awards Committee, you don't get to receive a book award.
Okay.
You know? Yeah. And as a board member, I'm not eligible for any award, which, you know, is the way that it should be. But also, I think it's important for everyone to know that there really are very strict guidelines and bylaws that we spent a lot of time writing for each of the categories. And mm-hmm. You know, if it's broadcast, which is, you know, TV and, you know, media, or journalism, or books, or restaurants and chefs, we have committees that meet several times a year, and the committees are then, they have specific judges that judge in all the categories, and they really take their jobs very, very seriously, and they really want to make sure that they're doing it in a proper way, in a fair way.
So. Sure. I mean, I think, you know, to be honest, it's like with any award. I'm really proud that we do publish the list of the semifinalists because, you know, that gives people a sense of the working list. It gives people a sense of the scope of who's being considered. And it's nice to be recognized even in that way because, you know, then it gets narrowed down to a much smaller field and to an ultimate, you know, ultimately a winner. But it's like with anything else in life. It's like, you know, you can't always win, and it's just, you know, there's always going to be that bittersweet disappointment, but hopefully the fabulous party at Lincoln Center and the after parties and then the after parties with, you know,
it's
Danielle Ballou and Daniel
Hoom
all over New York, hopefully they make up for some of that. We're going to take a short break, and then we'll be back to talk more with Emily Lucchetti on Taste Matters.
This one's called Spreadin' Honey by the California Honey Drops on heritageradionetwork.org.
You better do what you want when you get up in the morning, 'cause it won't be long before you're dead and gone.
Yeah.
No, there ain't no telling. Yeah, we all just bet. Just plan our hand till the last stand. So tell your mama you've been spreading honey, won't you? Tell your brother you've been spreading honey, won't you? Tell your sister you've been spreading honey, won't they? Come along and spread some honey too. Oh, won't they? Come along and spread some honey too.
Blueprint is the original juice cleanse program to offer different levels of intensity depending on your needs and current diet. Designed to purify and detoxify, Blueprint Cleanse is made from the freshest 100% raw and USDA certified organic ingredients, cold pressed to retain nutrients and flavor. Blueprint also offers a line of organic juices, cold pressed and raw, in a variety of fruit and vegetable combinations and available in individual bottles. Blueprint Cleanse is available at Whole Foods Market and many other retailers across the U.S. To learn more about their line of organic cleanses, juices, and other products, visit them today at blueprint.com or call them at 866-774-6831. That's 866-774-6831. Work hard, play hard. Cleanse, repeat.
And we're back. You're listening to Isabella Wojcik on Taste Matters on the venerable heritageradionetwork.org, where I'm very proud to mention it is May. It's May 1, and it's also Membership Drive Month. So please remember, it's a non-for-profit that absolutely needs your support. So go to heritageradionetwork.org, click on Donate, find out more about how to support, how to be involved, and how to be part of it all. But thank you for joining me and listening to Emily Lucchetti, the really talented and the very smart executive pastry chef, but really we're going to call her chief pastry officer of Farallon Water Bar in San Francisco. I wanted to mention the first time I mean, I've been aware of Emily's reputation since Stars, and she was the pastry chef at Stars, a Jeremiah Tower restaurant in San Francisco. Not to date us or anything, because we're just, you know, a couple of years old, but
we're timeless.
But I remember the book. I remember reading about your style. But the first time I ever got to meet you was at the Beard House, and you brought a wonderful concept to me, an event by way of a holiday-themed cocktail party, gingerbread house decorating party for adults. You brought another wonderful soul from the Northern Bay area, Beth Casey, and we kind of threw this party where it was sweets, it was savory snacks, while the grown-ups were kind of having cocktails and making a big mess on the second floor of the Beard House. And I was so charmed by you, and I've just really admired the way that you've both been a leader involved in the foundation and just a very lovely person. So I feel like that must put out great work into the universe by way of your pastry chefs where they're working.
Thank you. That's
so
very
so
nice.
Let's talk about that. How just quickly take us through, you know, how did you even fall into Stars? And then what's your life been like as a pastry chef from the kind of early grunt days to maybe, you know, now being more of a manager to being now more of a leader? Tell us more about that.
Well, I originally got to Stars. I just moved to San Francisco with my boyfriend, who is now my husband for 30 years, so that's how far we go back.
Shh.
But we had just moved to San Francisco, and Stars was about to open, and I had cooked for a couple of years in New York, and I got a job at Stars, and no one really knew what it was. I mean, obviously, Jeremiah had his vision of what it was going to be, but no one, you know, before something takes off, you don't know what's going to happen or how much it's going to affect society or anything like that. So we opened Stars, and it was just phenomenal. And I worked there for about 11 years. And, you know, in the beginning, I think it's a very young business, and people that work behind the stove in the kitchen and work in the front of the house, you're on your feet all day, and they're 14 hours days, and it's all very exciting and it's all very fun. But after you start to get a little older, it's like, I just can't physically do this anymore. And so either people get out of the business or they kind of look for new challenges and new things to do. And for me, that was, you know, starting to write cookbooks. And also, you know, I've discovered that I really do like to write, and I kind of like to kind of let people know about what's going on in the pastry world. So it's not really writing about me. It's kind of writing about what things are going on around me or in desserts. And so I just kind of have slowly morphed into that. And obviously, I still have a big hand in restaurants because that's kind of who I am, and that's, you know, where I feel my heart is. But it's interesting because at the same time where you physically can't do it and you kind of move on, you miss it. I mean, you know, you kind of miss the, you know, you want to go in there and you want to crank out all those desserts all day and really kind of do the volume and get the adrenaline going and that kind of thing. But it just, you know, everybody has to move on. And you also have to evolve because for me, you know, I got to the point where I knew I was, you know, doing the desserts, you know, really well, and, you know, and I was cranking them out. But one, there were people behind me that were doing it really well, too, and I wanted them to, you know, that worked for me, that I wanted them to have more experiences. And after a while, you just want to move on, you know, to kind of new challenges and different things.
So tell us about dessert trends, since you touched upon that, you know, in your work and in your writing. When you were at Stars and then maybe at Farallon, can you tell us what the desserts were like then? What was the trend then, or what was the style, or what were pastry chefs thinking about then?
Well, you know, back in the Stars days, I mean, we would do such simple kind of American desserts and even simple French desserts, kind of, you know, grandmothers or mothers cooking, because most of the desserts weren't that fresh, they weren't that flavorful, you know, before that. And so if you came out and you did even a really good angel food cake with fresh peaches that were, you know, picked at the ripe of perfection and Chantilly cream, I mean, people thought you were a god because, you know, it was just so simple, but it tasted so good. And so I think that was the way for a while, was just really simplicity, really straightforward, and just absolutely, absolutely delicious. And everyone was kind of doing that. But then as pastry has grown over the last 10, 15, even 20 years, many, many more styles are coming out. And that's what's really fun about it. And that kind of what we were talking about with the awards earlier. I mean, you know, we went from simple desserts to architectural desserts, and it looked like people had their hands all over your food while they were, you know, putting it together back in the kitchen. And, you know, they did have their hands all over your food. But then after that, it kind of went in four or five different directions. Some people stayed simple. Some people stayed simple but got a little bit more sophisticated. Some people went into, you know, the whole molecular thing. And so, and some people have stayed architectural and very, you know, tight and very refined. So it's really kind of gone in so many different ways, and it all goes back to the personality of the pastry chef.
And I guess you can even say now we've crossed the bridge from sweet to savory in our desserts. Would you agree?
Yes, I mean, we have crossed the bridge from sweet to savory, but I think the most important thing is that if you go to good quality restaurants or bakeries, people will always say, this was good, it wasn't too sweet. Because I think America for so long had just been sent and been delivered all these desserts that had way too much sugar in them. So one, they were too sweet, and also when you make something too sweet, it masks the flavor. So it doesn't taste as orangey or as pecan-y or as chocolatey as it really could. It doesn't have that intensity. So you don't have that pleasure, and also you don't have that satiety. And, you know, because if you eat like a Hershey's bar that is really sweet, you need to eat about three of them before you feel like, God, I've had enough. But if you eat, you know, 70% dark chocolate from Moss Brothers or Dandelion Chocolate in San Francisco, you can have just, you know, an ounce or two, mm-hmm. and it's like, wow, that was intense, and that was great. So I think it's more of the fact that it's just people are really focusing on flavor, and they're taking a lot of sugar out of it. And, yes, they're starting to add savory elements and turning it into something, you know, sweet, like a beet or a carrot or something like that. But they're just using that beet or the carrot or the rosemary as a vehicle in their desserts, as an ingredient. It's not like they're really doing savory desserts. They're just really looking at the culinary side of the kitchen, mm-hmm. and taking some of their stuff and pulling it over and using it in their pantry.
Do you see at all influence that are regional or West Coast versus East Coast? Is that an impacting thing, or is it really not, because we're no longer maybe grounded in where we live? Like, maybe we're more virtual in the way that we share information, share recipes. But do you think there's a...
I think it's a combination of both. I think we are virtual, where it's so, you know, easy these days to get experiences and get, you know, sparked by creativity that someone else is doing. I mean, you know, a simple example, in the old days, if you wanted to get a dessert menu from a restaurant, you had to go there. So you'd go to the restaurant, and you'd take the menu back to all your pastry people, and you'd all go over it, and you'd look at it, and you'd describe the desserts. Well, now you can go online and get their menu, plus you can, you know, go, you know, often see their photographs of their desserts. So you don't have to physically go to that place. But I think people are really cooking to... from where they are, where they physically are, whether it's the South, whether it's, you know, a city. And it's not just from a geographical place. It's kind of like a geographical place inside of that person. So, you know, I could be in New York or I could be in San Francisco, and I'm going to do the same style of desserts because I'm rooted in one of those already inside my body. Hmm. So I think that's kind of where it's coming from. But I also think that all these kind of emphasis are going, you know, kind of coming together. Like, you know, we all, you know, people kind of laugh when you talk in the field about food, because, you know, New Yorkers will say about California, this is in the old days, it really isn't now, that, you know, a California will put a tomato on a plate and call it lunch, and then, you know, and call it a restaurant dish, and then and then the Californians will say, well, the New Yorker will take the tomato and they'll do so much to it, it doesn't taste like it's a real tomato, that it just came right out of the field. So I don't, you know, those are the two wild extremes. But I really think that they're coming together, and it's like how to make that tomato or whatever you're talking about taste the best it can absolutely taste, and add the creative influence of the person that's, you know, making the dish.
Right. Emily, we're almost out of time, so I wanted to squeeze in a little information about you. To make sure listeners visit your website, emilylucchetti.com. They can certainly follow you on Twitter at emilylucchetti. Are you around the restaurants? Can they see you on the West Coast, or are you more behind the scenes
in
your
books? I'm at the restaurants. I come to New York and do, you know, the Beard Foundation, you know, stuff quite a bit. But, no, San Francisco is definitely my home. And I would like to put it, obviously, if people are listening to this, they're hopefully members of Heritage Radio, but I really want to put a plug in for Heritage Radio if people are listening to the show and they haven't been in their $60, because it is phenomenal. The amount of information and amount of shows and learning and stuff. I mean, I go on Heritage Radio every week and talk about learning about things, about food and about culture. I mean, it's almost like a PhD continuing education class. It really is brilliant. And I think the more people that listen to it, obviously, is great. But even we really have to, you know, get it all the funding that it absolutely needs. So
Thank you.
If I used up the last minute on that, I think it was well worth it.
No, thank you, Emily. Thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate that. I wish we had more to talk about, even more.
Oh, we could have talked for another half hour, at least.
Sign of a good friendship. So thank you again for listening to Taste Matters. Next week, Mitchell is back with the revered chef Danielle Ballou. That should be a very exciting conversation. But thank you again, Emily, for being on the show. And thank you for joining us. Taste Matters, heritageradionetwork.org.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.